Good morning.
I
want to thank James for at the last minute saying, hey, do most of my job for me, please. So thank you. It makes this possible. Excuse me. So I'm going to do the best I can. You do the best you can, and we'll just get through it. So as the slide on the screen would say, or indicates, we're looking again at 1 Corinthians. And we looked at a little bit at the 1 Corinthians reading from, I think, 2 weeks ago. Today we're going to do it a little more specifically. And as Paul is writing these letters to a church in a city called Corinth, he's dealing with a lot of issues that will make any church, most churches anyway, seem a lot more sane. The church in Corinth had a lot of struggles, and a lot of their members were caught up in things that we would rightly find kind of crazy. And part of that is because part of it has to do with the city Corinth itself. Corinth was a port town, a lot of shipping enterprise, a lot of business, a lot of merchants would travel through there or set up shop there. So there was a lot of money, a lot of weirdness. It was kind of like a hub of not just commercial activity, but also like religious activity as well. And when I say that, I don't mean like Christians. I mean worshipers of different Greek or Roman gods and goddesses. In particular, Corinth was at least known for its worship of Aphrodite. Aphrodite being the goddess of sex and carnal knowledge and all kinds of other interesting things that go along with that. And without getting into the details, worship of Aphrodite would reflect that. And that, as you might imagine, caused some interesting issues for new Christians in the city of Corinth. Now, in our reading today, Paul is making some claims and cautions that may seem out of left field. He's suddenly talking about knowledge, puffing up, and you know that idols aren't real, and something about eating meat or something like that. And it's a little confusing for modern ears. So to get at that, I want you to imagine somebody living in the city of Corinth who is, they themselves are ethnically Greek. Their parents, ethnically Greek. Their grandparents, ethnically Greek. In other words, no connection to what we would call Judaism, or what they would call themselves as the one true God, or anything like that. And if you live in Corinth, maybe you worship Aphrodite. A lot of people would have particular gods or goddesses that they would worship, and that worship would entail all kinds of things that we'll get into in a minute. So as this person, you have lived your whole life with a very specific worldview that sees or explains the processes and the different experiences in life through the lens of the what we would call the Greco-Roman pantheon, Greek gods and goddesses. And just like today, we have maybe like materialist or scientific ways of explaining different processes. They would explain a lot of these processes through, to use a modern word, religion. So say you meet somebody and you feel that connection and attraction, what we would eventually call like love or attraction or something like that. They would say, well, you've been hit by Cupid's arrow. They're not being cute, like they really thought that. Whereas today we would say that it's a very complex process of psychosocial reasons and neurological stuff and neuropsychiatric stuff that I don't even understand. I'm kind of making words up at this point. And so they saw that everything was permeated by the activities of the gods. Especially if you lean more on the Stoic side. And if that doesn't make sense to you, just ignore me. the tricky thing with that is that the Greco-Roman gods were fickle. They were very much pay to play. If you want something from a god or goddess, it's going to cost you something. And even then, they might help you out, or they may crush you depending on their mood. Certain gods or goddesses were moodier than others. Certain gods or goddesses had certain values. And that sometimes spoke to how a city that would really particularly like that god, how it would be oriented. So, for example, the Greek city of Athens really valued knowledge and wisdom and learning. So naturally, they were mostly attracted to the goddess Athena, the goddess of wisdom. Corinth had things like Aphrodite. Again, this gets complicated. So you would view the world as very much hard to predict, very much pay to play. You've got to sacrifice something to the gods. Maybe they will help you, or maybe they won't. There's a Latin phrase, fatigare Deus, fatiguing a god, basically annoying them to the point that they finally say, I give up. Fine, I'll help you. That's your world. And these gods and goddesses are represented by idols. They are worshipped in temples. They are sacrificed to temples. Now, at some point in this imaginary scenario, you encounter a group of people that are very strange as far as your Greek sensibilities go, and Roman sensibilities, maybe even more so Roman, because they live differently. They, for example, actually care about you. And that's weird, because they're not related to you. You don't have a business relationship with them in any way. And so unlike basically everybody else you've met, they care about your well-being, and they have no reason to. It sounds strange to us, or to modern ears, I hope, but this kind of thing would have been very new in about the middle of the first century, and these groups were starting to spread throughout the Mediterranean world. They also had some strange beliefs. They believed that there was one God. And they actually didn't really believe that any of the other gods existed, which is likewise very strange. They lived fairly strict lives. There were a lot of normal Greek things that they didn't get involved in. No drunken revelry and other kinds of weird sexual worship and stuff like that. They abstained from that. They lived what we would eventually say very moral, upright lives, very kind, caring people. And then even weirder, if you press them about why they live like this, they would say that the one true God is the God that we serve. He is the one that created all things. And that's weird, because the Greeks and Romans didn't really have a God that created everything. That wasn't in their worldview. And this group said that this God is profoundly faithful, which again is weird. This is not a God that you manipulate to get your way. And they would say that he's been telling a story or a history for a very long time, going all the way back to this guy named Abraham, and he made a promise. He said, I will be your God. You and your descendants will be my people. I will protect you and I will love you and you will worship me and me alone. And the history of those peoples is complicated because they're human beings. And even though sometimes or very often they would go off and worship other things, other gods, which broke this God's heart, he was always faithful and steadfast. He would continue to love them even though he had no reason to, because they're the ones that broke that mutual promise that they made to each other. Now, all of that is strange, but it gets weirder. Because they would then say that they have had the privilege to see that God, in this long story of his faithfulness that he's been telling, where this story will reach its climax, its fulfillment, the big reveal. That in his faithfulness, he will send his son. His son, who is both man and God, which is maybe a little easier to understand for a Greek, potentially. And he would go around and he took on this mantle, he took on the role of humanity, he took on the role of the descendants of Father Abraham, what we would call Israel. And in the shocking twist, this one that they worship gave up his life for the sake of humanity by dying from execution on a cross, crucifixion. And that would, if that doesn't send you over the edge, nothing will for this hypothetical Corinthian resident. the Roman order, Cicero, would actually say that any good Roman citizen, and this would apply to Greek as well, would never talk about crucifixion. It's taboo because it's so extreme. It's, excuse me, apologize, I couldn't mute it. It was so extreme and so shameful that it should never be on your lips. And so if that they thought that was weird, they would say, but that's not where the story ends. God demonstrated that this truly was the fulfillment of his plan, of his steadfast, faithful love by raising him from the dead. Now, within the Greek and Roman worldview, there is no such thing as resurrection. Very few references to any kind of like physical life after death, and the main one that I'm thinking of, it's just it mentions it briefly and just says basically we know that never happens. It would just shatter anything that you would come to believe about reality itself. This is the opposite in some ways of what you believed about the world. But they would say like this is why we love you. This is why we care about you. Because if our God was willing to do that for us, why wouldn't we be willing to do that for you? Now, then imagine this hypothetical Corinthian resident, if that's you or just some person, it doesn't matter. You find this very compelling, and you come to faith. You follow this Jesus, this God-man, this fulfillment of God's steadfast loyalty and his love. And so you receive baptism, which means you are buried with him. You die that death in baptism and you are raised to that new life. Well, now you have to rethink everything. Because everything you knew about the world has now changed. And it is hard to underscore how difficult that would be. It's hard to just get new ideas in our heads, new words or language in our heads, let alone a new way of viewing reality. I can prove to you why this is hard. How many of you have done this yourself, or you've seen people do it, and I don't have it on me at the moment, where somebody has pulled out their phone to make a video, and they said, okay, I'm going to tape this. Tape? Tape has not been part of that process for a very long time. But it's so embedded in our minds, or to run with that analogy, I truly don't even know what my ringtone is. I just leave it on vibrate the whole time. But sometimes it'll be bzz, 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 and I go, hold on, my phone's ringing. No, it's not. It's just vibrating against the couch. Now, multiply that by the way you view now not just yourself, but the world around you. That you're part of this story now of God entering into and redeeming reality. And not only that, but these gods that you've worshipped, that you've sacrificed to over and over, you've begged and pleaded with them to rescue you and save you. And sometimes it worked out. Sometimes they said, not my problem. You are not my problem. I'm not obligated to you. And then whatever, you were just left high and dry. You spent your whole life following them. Now you're trying to figure out, what does it mean that God has done for me something that I could not do for myself? How do I live in a city like Corinth? Now imagine you've got some friend who is a follower of Jesus. He's within this little community. Maybe somebody that is part of the group of people that Paul wrote to. I don't know. And you're walking down that main street, and this guy is a mature, faithful follower of Jesus. He knows and loves the scriptures. In fact, he's helped mentor you to figure out what it means to follow this Jesus. He's a good man and loves Jesus. And apparently he's shopping. Now, one other thing that you need to know is that that especially Greeks and Romans, they're very superstitious. And because the gods constantly demanded sacrifice, which is very different from the God of the Hebrews, where sacrifice was part of engagement. This was, in the Greek sense, these sacrifices were, all right, just so you don't crush our city, or you don't get really mad, or maybe we can get something out of you. It's just manipulation. So, especially for what we might call ranchers, people who raised like cattle and sheep and stuff like that, basically animals that you would consume for their meat, well, you would kind of go through the temple and you would sacrifice those animals to that god, and then they would make their way on out to the market, or that meat would be sold within that temple. Basically, as far as I'm aware, any meat that you encounter in that city will have been sacrificed to a god. Now you see your friend, as you're just brand new trying to figure out who this Jesus guy is, and you see him walking into the temple of Aphrodite just because he's hungry and he wants lamb for dinner. What kind of sense is that going to make? It's going to be, I would argue, very deeply confusing. Because now you've got to ask, well, is it okay then? Like, is he going into that temple to do the other kinds of worship with the Aphrodite's priestesses? Because I'm pretty sure that's not kosher. Pun sort of intended. Like, so is Aphrodite real? And if you're brand new to what it means to be following Jesus, that would be deeply confusing. Now, it's hard to come up with like a direct analogy, for us today, because as far as I know, there isn't like a temple to Aphrodite or Athena or whatever in Albuquerque. When I was living near San Francisco, that was probably not true. I didn't want to look, but you never know. Nothing against San Francisco. I liked it there. It was just weird. And so I'm going to pick another topic, which is sort of similar and in a lot of ways not, but the principle, I think, is easier to see this way. So take the issue of consuming alcohol. Now, I'm not against alcohol. I have a personal rule that there's like one kind of bourbon I don't keep in the house because it's so good. It's just too good. And I fell in love in California with double IPAs. Then I saw how many calories are in a serving, and I'm like, okay, every once in a while, just for pure caloric content. And Lutherans have a long tradition of really loving beer. But let's not pretend that alcohol is totally harmless, you know, because it's not. Now, on the one hand, Christian liberty. And Paul says this in the previous chapter, like, all things are permissible, like you are not bound by the law in the sense that there's nothing you can do to please God. Living a more moral life will not make God love you more. Entering into his family, what we might call coming to faith or being saved or however you want to talk about it, is something that you cannot do for yourself. And attempting to is going to either lead to despair because you will see your own imperfection, or you will think you have succeeded and become absolutely insufferable as a result. And so because of that, if our salvation, if our presence at the table of Jesus is not based on our behavior, then a Christian doesn't have a lot of restrictions. And yet, if I were to say, therefore, things like alcohol, go nuts. You can have as much as you want. Most everybody here is well old enough to have seen people destroy their lives with alcohol. And if I were to say, okay, therefore I'm just going to go nuts, I'll have as much as I want, it's not going to be that long until my health starts to decline or it starts to affect me. Or it starts to impair the way I think, or it'll start changing the wiring in my brain, and it'll affect my decisions. Over time, I'll become an embarrassment to my family. I won't function as well as I could have. It'll affect me in all kinds of ways. And so there's a tension there between, as Paul would say, there's a lot that's permissible as a follower of Jesus because you're kind of freed from needing to prove yourself to God. And yet, at the same time, what is beneficial in our lives? This is the operating principle of 1 Corinthians 8. Where on the one hand, yeah, these, these idols, these gods, they're not real. At best, or at worst, they're some kind of evil spirit, but they have no hold on you as a follower of Jesus. But if going into these temples and consuming this meat that is sacrificed to these gods or goddesses is going to be very confusing to these new Christians who are just trying to figure out what it means to live and follow and love Jesus, then if Jesus gave his life up for us, then maybe sometimes you have to figure out what rights that you have that you need to give up for the sake of others. And that calls for wisdom and experience. To run with the alcohol analogy, and I don't mean to pick on that, it's just kind of an easy one. And, you know, again, I'm not against alcohol. I'll have friends over or something like that, and we're gonna talk for a while. Let's have a couple of beers or something like that. Fine. Christian liberty. There's nothing wrong with any of that. But I've also had the experience of having somebody over and meeting up with them, and they're 2 months sober, or I know that there is a problem there. And they're unable to control it. And so the most Christian thing I can do is give up that right and freedom that I have, because I know it's going to be really hard for them to say no. So 1 Corinthians 8, it's not about the meat. It's not about the food. It's about our rights. The rights and freedoms that Jesus has won for us. And sometimes the most Christian thing we can do is give some of those up for the sake of others. Because on the one hand, God has done for us what we could not do for ourselves. You cannot make God love you anymore. You cannot make him save you. You cannot earn what he has done for you in Jesus. You cannot earn your baptism. You cannot earn the resurrection life. It is given to you freely. It is not a result of your behavior or just being a really good moral person, because we can't meet perfection. And on the other hand, out of that, if God is willing to give up his son for our sake, there are many situations in life, and they all call for wisdom, where we have to find a balance in that tension of claiming my right or giving up my right for the sake of my, not just brothers and sisters in Jesus, but my fellow brothers and sisters in shared humanity. And if you have a group of people who are so captured by the story and the love of Jesus that they're willing to do that, well, we know how that story is going to end. It's going to end with the spread of that love and that family, which is exactly what happens in the wake of Paul writing things like 1 Corinthians. Because it turns out this is a much better way to live, though again, it calls for wisdom. Amen.